You're listening to the Full and Thriving Podcast, a place where courageous women come to break free from food obsession, heal their relationship with their body, and strive to live a life that's present, lighthearted, and meaningful. If you're listening, my wish is that this podcast serves as a catalyst that inspires you to nourish your body, nurture your mind, and energize your spirit. I'm your host, Meg McCabe, a certified life coach and eating disorder recovery coach with a PhD in having a good time. Just kidding about that last part. Anyway, thank you so much for listening and enjoy the show. Today's guest is Dr. Jillian Lampert. Jillian is a registered dietitian nutritionist who currently serves as the chief strategy officer at Aconto Health, the parent company of the EMILY program and Veritas Collaborative. She has an expansive range of policy, clinical, research, education, teaching, and program development experience in the field of eating disorders. In this episode, Jillian and I discuss the relationship between isolation, anxiety, and eating disorders, and how these factors interact with each other. We also talk about how to reach out for help when it feels really scary and the value of social connection, which you all know I'm a huge fan of. This is truly a fantastic episode with an equally vibrant guest, and I know you're all going to love it. Hi, Jillian. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you? I'm so excited.
Oh, I'm so excited. Thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I can't wait to have you as a guest. It's been a long time coming. I'm so excited to finally have you here. How is your summer going?
It is good. I can't believe it's the middle of July. I'm not really sure how that happened, but it's good. I just got back from a little vacation doing some hiking in Colorado with my 19-year-old. So that was really fun. So I'm excited, rested and excited.
Wow. I don't know if you knew this, but I lived in Colorado for 4 years.
Wow. Yeah, we did a whole circle tour of Colorado. You probably know everywhere we went, and it was awesome. And the altitude was real.
Yes. I feel like it took me months to adjust to altitude. People say it takes a few days, and I didn't feel like myself for at least 2 months when I moved out.
I believe it. It definitely got better, and we probably went a little too hard on the, like, let's start hiking tomorrow, which I know you're not really supposed to do, but we had a lot to see. And so by day 3 or 4, we started to feel like, okay, this is manageable. But I did feel like a bit of a superhero when I walked out of the airport in Minnesota, which is at, like, you know, practically sea level. Walked out, I was like, wow, can I breathe really well?
Oh my gosh. And I'm assuming if you go on like a run or if you do a hike or something here, you're going to feel amazing.
Yeah, I was like, I think I can ride this for like at least a week. All these new red blood cells I have. I'm so excited.
Yes. Oh, I love that. What was your favorite place in Colorado that you saw?
What was our favorite place? You know, we did a Jeep tour up in the mountains in Ouray. That was really cool. I think some of the hikes in Rocky Mountain National Park were probably really cool. One day we did a hike. Where was that? In Aspen at the Maroon Bells. And we saw a couple get engaged and we actually got involved because they asked, like, one of the couple's mom asked us to take pictures. And so we got to like watch these strangers get engaged. It was so much fun.
Oh, that's so cute. Yeah. Oh, I love that. And Maroon Bells is gorgeous.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. Wow. What a lovely trip.
Yeah.
That sounds fabulous. Well, you know, I know you were probably sad to leave Colorado, but now you're here and we get to talk about eating disorders. And I'm sure you talk about this all day. So do I. But before we dive into our topic for today, which is about isolation and anxiety and eating disorders, I'd love to know what inspired your career in eating disorders.
Oh, sort of a long meandering story, which I will make short, but I was sort of in the right place at the right time and didn't know this is what I wanted to do. But apparently the universe knew for me. I had an eating disorder in high school and college, which is not why I went into eating disorders. I'm really grateful to be recovered. It was a really awful experience, as so many people have an eating disorder experience. You know, this is a terrible illness to have. So grateful I got better. And I really didn't build a career around it. And I talk to people, you know, all the time who are like, I had an eating disorder. I want to do this for a living. I'm like, that's beautiful. I didn't even know that there was a thing to do with it. I just had this terrible experience. And then when I was in college, I was going to go to med school. That was my whole plan since I was like six. I was going to go to med school. And I got into college. And by my sophomore year, I decided I didn't want to be a doctor. I didn't want to go to medical school. So I called my parents and I said, you know, I've been thinking a lot and I've been taking this class. It was a, don't laugh, it was an aerobics instructor training class that was like done in some like, you know, a small little conference room on campus somewhere. It was very embarrassing. But I mean, aerobics instructing was cool, but like the whole process was ridiculous. It didn't look anything like any kind of studio you would actually want to jump on those floors. But be that as it may, I had a great experience in this class because there was a pretty in-depth nutrition section in the class. And I found it just fascinating. And I thought, well, I know I still want to be in healthcare or somehow health related, but I don't want to go to medical school. This nutrition thing sounds really cool. And so I called my parents and said, I think I want to go into nutrition. And from that phone call on, it probably took about 10, maybe 12 years for my parents to figure out what on earth I was talking about, because they just didn't have a concept of like, what that meant. And it was really clear what being a doctor meant. And I said, no, I think I want to go into nutrition and I think I want to go to graduate school and I might want to be a dietitian. And I don't know. There's just so much interesting interest in this I have. And my parents said, that's because you have an eating disorder. And I said, no, it's not. And I get it. Like as a clinician years later, I get it. I totally get why they thought that. And I knew somewhere deep down, I knew that it wasn't because I had an eating disorder. I just really liked it. And so I had a scholarship that I had to maintain a certain major to keep, which was so wonderful. So I finished my biology degree and I took nutrition classes. And then I went to graduate school in nutrition. And then I went to more graduate school in nutrition. And then I went to more graduate school. So I got all these degrees in nutrition and public health nutrition and epidemiology and all the things, and studied nutrition. And all along the way, I kept getting opportunities to work in eating disorders. And not that I really tried, but they just kept happening. And so my first job as a dietitian, my boss said on like day one, working at this small hospital, said, what do you know about eating disorders? And I said, well, I just trained in one of the only eating disorder programs in the country at the time at the University of Minnesota. So I have actually some pretty good training. It was also really clear to me back at that point, this was in the early 90s, that you didn't really talk about having had an eating disorder. It just wasn't a thing you talked about, which I'm so glad that that has changed. So I started an eating disorder program at that hospital. Then I went on to work in another eating disorder program because somebody was like, hey, aren't you an eating disorder dietitian? And it just kept happening. And so I realized somewhere along the lines that this was going to be my career. As I was finishing my PhD and deciding if I wanted to stay in academia or not, I had some really great opportunities to work in a clinical setting and to really take on executive roles. And that's what I've done ever since. So I've been in the field for about 30 years and I've worked clinically as a dietitian for 25 of those 30 years. But most of my positions have been in executive leadership around clinical research, education, communication, really getting the word out about eating disorders and trying to help reduce the stigma and the shame and increase awareness. And then a little bit after the beginning of my career, I was able to start really working in policy as well. And so I'm so lucky and have been able to do and able to do the things I love. I love it that I have a job that's just perfect for me.
Wow, what an incredible career path for you. And I just love it how your purpose sort of found you.
It did. Followed me around. It was like, hello, knock, knock.
I always say your purpose will chase you down.
Yep.
And I do feel like your life is a good example of that. And I'm really curious, like, I'm assuming you fell in love with the topic of eating disorders at this point. And why is this topic so important to you?
I think it's so important because, you know, I just said this to somebody yesterday, like, if we don't care about this, who will? Because any topic takes passion and takes passion to people who care about it to make a difference in the world. And so if those of us who understand eating disorders or have been touched by eating disorders personally or professionally or have some passion about it for some reason, if we don't do the work and we don't do all the work and dive in full with our whole selves, no one else will. This is not a casual interest to most people. Like if you are interested in eating disorders, it's for some sort of reason. And I love that we can make a difference. And I've seen the field make a huge difference in the last, you know, 30 years of my career. I just love what we do because at the end of the day, we're making life a little easier for people and collectively, we're saving lives. Like, what better purpose to have than to help somebody get through these illnesses, not have them, and have their loved ones and those who care for them know what to do? That's an awesome thing. So I am always thinking about what a huge difference we can make, because if we don't do it, who will?
Yeah, that is so true. Like you said, back in the 80s, nobody was even talking about eating disorders, and things have drastically changed, and it's a little less taboo and less stigmatized, still heavily stigmatized, but still, at least we have a safer place for people to talk about it and get help and find resources they need, and it's actually appropriate care. So yeah, so much can happen and change in just a few decades in this field, which is really exciting.
It is. I remember when I was sick, the first doctor's appointment I had, my doctor literally said, and I get it, he had no idea, no education, but he said, "When do you think you're going to be done with this?" And I was like, have you ever asked anybody with any other health condition when they think they're going to be done with this? And I didn't say that because I was trying to be polite, probably. But in my head, I was like, nobody gets asked that about a broken leg. What on earth is happening? So you're right. We've made a huge amount of difference and forward momentum in the field. And I'm sure there are still situations that people have where the people they talk to are not well informed, but I hope not nearly as often.
Yeah, it's actually cool to reflect back on my eating disorder experience too, because back when I had my eating disorder in high school and in college, my local pediatrician didn't really see it. It just flew under the radar. You know, I was an athlete, wasn't questioned that I wasn't getting my period or anything because I was an athlete.
Right.
And now actually I live back home and I have a great working relationship with him to support his patients with eating disorders. Oh. So it's funny how things have changed in like 15-ish more or plus years since I was in that spot.
That's awesome. That's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah. So, wow. Thank you for sharing all of that. So let's dive into our topic. Yeah. And I really wanted to just ask, like, how do you see anxiety, isolation, and eating disorders like working together? How do they interact with each other and how do they influence each other in this space?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think nothing illustrated how they work together better than COVID, right? That that experience of extreme isolation and extreme anxiety really drove that home for me. And so when I think about it, if you were to like, you know, write a recipe to get an eating disorder, you would take a lot of anxiety, a lot of worry, a lot of thinking about things, a lot of comparing, a lot of wondering if you're okay, if wondering if it'll be okay, wondering if you're doing things right, right? That's, you know, in a simple version, that's what anxiety is. If you take a lot of that, which lots and lots and lots of people have, those questions and that experience, and then you have a lot of messaging around like, well, this is what you would do if you were okay. This is what you would eat. This is what you would look like. This is what you would wear. This is how you would appear in society. This is how you would put yourself out there. Here's how you would act. With all those expectations around how you should show up in the world, gives you even more to worry about and more to be anxious about. And then eating disorder behaviors keep people isolated. And I tell my students and I've talked to clients, like eating disorder behaviors, there's some really weird things that people with eating disorders do. I did a lot of weird things when I had an eating disorder. I'm sure that it's not the technical terms, but right, I did a lot of weird things with food, with exercise, with all the things. And humans do a lot of weird things with food and activity and what we do with our eating and our thoughts about our bodies. And people with eating disorders are really, in a simple way, I think, just experiencing the extremes of those behaviors.
Yeah.
And if you're experiencing the extreme of a behavior, it tends not to be the thing you like talk a lot about or like, hey guys, I did this thing last night. So we tend to become isolated by not really wanting to share the experience because it doesn't seem socially acceptable to share that experience. And in some ways it might be like if you're, you know, if one of your eating disorder behaviors is restricting your food intake, you can find plenty of tables to plop down at, you know, break time at work or a cafe and talk about your latest diet or your latest activity or whatever. That's really a difficult spot. But so many of the eating disorder behaviors happen in isolation. They come along with shame. Nobody's really plopping down at those same tables and be like, hey, guess what? I binged last night and I ate all of these things and I ate this and I ate that nut and then I threw up. Like nobody says that, right? So the isolation of the behaviors themselves, I think adds to the isolation of, am I okay? Am I doing the right things? How does it all work? So I think if you take somebody who's probably genetically, you know, has genetic influences to be a more noticing, more highly wired, more anxious wired person, and give them a whole bunch of expectations to meet and that society will set and follow up on regularly, and then have the behaviors they're doing be a little bit extreme, that's a recipe for having an eating disorder. So they really do all tie together, that anxiety, yeah, that isolation, and the eating disorder behaviors. And recovery really needs to, you know, put the sunlight on the person and support them in a community so that they can have different ways of interacting and different ways of experiencing their own beautiful genetic wiring.
Yeah, yeah. You're so right with talking about how there are some things people feel okay talking about, like the diet culture, but that's the least shameful piece because that's almost celebrated in our culture.
Absolutely.
And then you take just another step forward and there's so much, I'm assuming, those people in the break room aren't talking about. And when you don't talk about something, you feel isolated, even when you're surrounded by other people.
Right. Absolutely. You feel more isolated. Like, here I am, but I can't talk about it. What am I going to talk about? They won't possibly know what I'm talking about. They won't possibly identify with it. I must be wrong. This must be something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's why it's so important to break isolation when you're in recovery and try to work through that. I remember when I was going through my eating disorder, I felt so afraid and ashamed to talk about the behaviors I was experiencing. And that actually taught me a lot about what shame feels like because I was so young. So now in life, whenever I find myself not talking about anything, I think back to when I was like binging in the cabinet and not telling anybody.
Yep.
I'm like, this is an example of shame coming up. You know, it's actually quite a learning experience too.
It certainly is. It certainly is. That's my husband and I joke seriously. Like, oh, I didn't really know if I wanted to talk to you about this. So I knew I had to.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Oh, what a great phrase there. I feel like that's a phrase my therapist would love.
Feel free to use it.
Okay, so why do you think eating disorders thrive in isolation? Like, how do eating disorders really influence people to isolate?
I think it's like if eating disorders were a physics problem, and I'm going to get this all wrong because I'm not a physics major, but if like eating disorders were a physics problem or like a black hole in space, they gather all this energy in and they do it in this quiet, very subtle, but very strong way. So if somebody is like, oh, I need to do this thing to feel better, so whatever the behavior is, and then you realize like, oh, that might be sort of odd if everybody knew about that, or maybe if somebody knew about that, they wouldn't want me to do that. And so I'm just going to keep it to myself. And gosh, if people knew that it took me, you know, an hour and a half to get dressed in the morning because I can't decide what to wear because I can't figure out how to feel comfortable in my body. Again, we're not just going to plop down at the table and be like, hey, do you guys take an hour and a half to get dressed in the morning and go through, you know, 30 outfits and cry? That's not a super typical experience, or at least it's not an experience that a lot of people are talking about. So I think you're right. I think it's the shame of experiencing the behaviors and not feeling like they're things you could talk about because people would think that we're really odd. And on some level, the eating disorder behaviors, and we know about this from all the really awesome neurobiology research, that there's some anxiety reducing quality to some of these behaviors. And that's probably what keeps them around, at least in part, that if I do this sort of odd thing, I actually feel a little better. And I'd like to feel a little better. We'd all like to feel a little better. That's what our brains are looking for, is to feel good. And so if we have a behavior that helps us to feel a little bit better, but it's something that like not everybody's doing or we don't really want to talk about, we're not going to talk about it, but we're also not going to stop doing it because it helps us feel a little better. And then if it's societally, you know, lauded, well, then we're totally going to keep doing whatever it is, even if we're not talking about what we're doing. If the results are really, you know, lauded by society, then why would we tell anybody? Why would we talk about it? It isolates us into ourselves with the behaviors and the thoughts.
Yeah. And do you know what I find with the behaviors that are really weird? We just start normalizing them in our heads.
Totally.
So then they stop being weird to us.
Right.
Because we're isolated, we have no one to put us in check, right? Or put it in place and be like, hey, that's a little strange. You don't cook with any olive oil or butter and you just cook your vegetables with water. Don't you think that's a little strange?
Right.
Like, there have been clients of mine who have normalized things like that as an example, but so many other things where, and a lot stranger things, because they're not talking about it and it just becomes the cultural norm within their own selves.
Right. Well, and there's so many examples, I think. You know, I know we could, I don't want to take us too far afield, but a significant tangent we can take is, what does social media do to influence all of those things? Because people do all sorts of weird things, right? Like, just go on social media if you want to see all the weird things people do. So if it doesn't seem like a weird thing that you've seen on social media somewhere or somebody has talked about, then you might think, like, maybe I'm doing something different or something that nobody would want me to talk about because I don't even see it there. And so we have all of these sort of echo chambers to test out, is this a weird thing? And if it's something that we don't see somewhere else, then we really don't think we should talk about it. And we also, again, you know, it feels like it's kind of okay and I've normalized it and I feel better when I do it. So why would I tell you about it? And you might suggest that I stop doing it? I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So do you know, you know, what are some of the common signs that someone's isolating from an eating disorder?
I think the thing that just crossed my mind too is the more we isolate, the harder it is to connect. And also, as the eating disorder progresses, right, we start to have the physical impacts of the eating disorder behaviors, and then we get all irritable, or we experience even deeper depression or other psychological experiences that make it even harder to connect. And so that continues to foster the isolation, like, oh, I'm too tired. You know, the classic, like, I already ate, or I already, you know, I'm busy and I have to do something. But I think the signs are, the more subtle signs are really high irritability that leads people to, like, leave conversations with people and connections with people and go isolate, because it just feels easier in their mind and their experience to not expend the effort to connect with those people, because those people don't get it and they don't understand and they won't understand. And so just being by myself feels clearer. And I think eating disorders do make the world feel really a little simpler, a little just like blinders on or something that just makes the world feel a little simpler, a little clearer, and in a not very helpful way. But in that sort of simpler, clearer world, being isolated, being alone feels clearer. And so being with other people starts to be irritable and uncomfortable and challenging, and then people want to ask you questions and are worried about you. And why would you put yourself in that if you feel pretty good in this clear world? Except, of course, that's a false feel good, we know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good piece, is just recognizing, okay, am I starting to feel really irritable around people and having a difficult time connecting? Like, and that's due to the eating disorder, right? And of course, like, we don't want you to stay in that place. The eating disorder would love it, but we don't want you to stay in that place. And actually, connection is probably the most healing antidote to that.
Absolutely.
Wow. So, you know, what would you say? Like, one thing I was thinking of, and this is a classic example of someone isolating from the eating disorder, is constantly avoiding social events and actually getting tons of anxiety to the point where they're avoiding social events or avoiding, like, anything with eating, really. Like, do you have any tips or strategies on how to help someone kind of get move beyond that so that they can at least start connecting and not just staying isolated?
Absolutely. It's a little bit, I think that's where the literature that sort of looks at eating disorders as a bit of a, like, with a phobia lens can be helpful. If you say to somebody, like, oh, I really am uncomfortable going out to that restaurant with everybody, so I'm just going to stay home, they might be like, well, why? You love that food, or you love those people, or, you know, just come with us, it'll be fine. If instead you told that person, like, I want to go to the restaurant, but it's almost as if, like, I'm afraid of spiders and the restaurant is full of spiders, and you're asking me to sit around all night with spiders all over the place and be calm and just, you know, connect and have it be okay. And I'm afraid of spiders. And I think helping people to understand that can be how it feels for the person with the eating disorder can be helpful. But you do need, like, the first step, which is always the hardest, but really helpful, is to break through that and say, hey, I'm really afraid to go to this restaurant because it's almost like I'm afraid of spiders and it feels like a room full of spiders. Can you help me? And just blurting it out can be so helpful to have that person then say, oh, yeah, come with me. I'll sit next to you. What kind of support can I give you? Giving people more information on how to support you can be really helpful to managing the anxiety related to coming out of the isolation. And that's the cruel trick of eating disorders, one of the many, right? That getting reconnected has even more anxiety than staying isolated. And you're already feeling anxiety and isolation, and now you're making yourself feel more anxious. And the good news is that you will feel less anxious over time with support.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love that little tip and the comparison with the room full of spiders, and then being able to express that to someone you trust. That's a huge step. And I find that helps decrease the shame too, being able to get over that hump of like keeping it to yourself versus just blurting it out. Yep. The power of a good blurt.
Yeah.
You know what I'm
saying? Totally.
It's so true. Yeah. Why do you think social connection is so valuable to folks with eating disorders? I know that you said connection actually increases anxiety at first, which I'm also curious about. But, you know, why is it so important?
Yeah, I think it's so important because, like so many things, saying it out loud, doing it is always going to be less terrible than thinking about doing those things for the most part. Like, isn't that kind of true that we're so worried about something or we think it's going to be something and we go and do it and we're like, oh, well, that wasn't so bad. It's the anticipation. It's the anticipatory anxiety that makes it feel so difficult. But once we're there, we're like kind of glad we did it or it wasn't so bad, particularly if we've had a blurt and told somebody what we need in a moment of, you know, vulnerability. We find out that other people actually might be able to understand a little bit of what we're experiencing. And also, even if they don't, even if they have no idea because they've never been afraid of spiders and that they totally don't get it, they at least understand us a little bit more. And that opens the window to us saying, you know, it would be helpful to me if you did this, which allows us to like crack open the door a little bit, to be a little bit more vulnerable, to say, here's something that I'm going to like tell on myself to you. If you see me do this, could you do this? And that really does help to reduce the anxiety. It's always going to be worse in our minds than when we're talking about it with another person, because in our minds, we're figuring out, you know, again, the genetic predisposition for eating disorders also usually gives people brains that can like consider a million different options. And so we've considered all the ways that that person could not be helpful to us. And we find out like, oh, actually, they're just going to do the thing they're going to do. And that might really be helpful. So maybe those, you know, majority of the things we imagine would happen actually don't. And it'll turn out to be okay, or at least a little okay.
Mm-hmm. That's such a helpful reminder that it's usually not as bad as our brains like to tell us it's going to be. Yeah. So, you know, we're talking so much about people feeling isolated and alone. And, you know, I assume there's a lot of anxiety also when it comes to reaching out to help. So what advice do you have to people listening who are afraid of reaching out? Like, what can they do to maybe ease that anxiety a little or make it easier for them in general?
Yeah, and I think keeping a lens of compassion can be really helpful, and to be really vulnerable in the asking. So like, hey, I don't know how I can help you and I really want to, and I'm probably going to screw this up, but is there anything I can do to help you? Like, we're going out to a restaurant. Could I order for you? Do you want me to sit next to you? Do you want me to leave you alone? Is there anything I can do? I'm really worried about you and I really want to help you. And I just want to do something that doesn't piss you off. Like, I think that that's, you know, a lot of times when people have tried to reach out to help somebody in their life with an eating disorder, they might have been met with some, you know, some resistance or some anger even, which I always, you know, tell people is a little like whisper in their ear. Like, if you ask somebody about something and they get mad at you for asking about it, you might be right. Right? Like, if yeah, I don't have an eating disorder and you're like, hey, I'm really worried you might have an eating disorder, can I help you? I'm not going to get mad at you and I'm going to be like, oh, really? Say more, right? But if I have an eating disorder, I'm going to be like, no, I'm fine, right? So be vulnerable and say like, I don't want you to be mad. I want to help you and I really love you. What can I do? And that I think people respond to. It's the, you know, encouraging the helper to also be really vulnerable and just say, what can I do? Gosh, I love you. Or I really want to support you. Or I'm just here for you. I want you to know that. And sometimes that help.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I know you do a lot of research and you're very into public health and epidemiology, which I love. What are your thoughts on the value of community when it comes to healing and the power of community when it comes to healing an eating disorder?
Yeah, I think it's everything. You know, the programs that I work for, the Emily Program and Veritas Collaborative and Gather, we have a whole concept that we build all of our programs on. Like our parent company's name is Acanto, which means beside in Italian. You can't be beside somebody unless you're with another person, right? And so we really believe in relationships. I believe in it personally. I believe in it for our clients. We built our companies around it. It's everything that helps in policy, like everything I do in communication and policy and clinical work all boils down to relationships because we really do need each other. And I'm like, sign me up first on the list for people who don't want to ask for help. Like I have that like gene, whatever that is. You know, I have the like, I do it gene. When my kid was little, that was probably one of their first phrases. Like, I do it, mommy. So I get it. And we really need each other. And it's hard to know that you need other people sometimes for some people, but it's okay because they need us. And, you know, I sometimes ask people to turn that around because so many people I've worked with eating disorders, like they're okay being needed. They're okay helping. They want to help. They're wonderful, amazing, beautiful human beings who are compassionate and want to help. And so they get the connection concept for someone else. It's like getting it for themselves that it's okay to need to be connected because that's what we got in this life is connection. And there's so much beauty and richness there. So really, relationships are the core of everything. I think we have to have community in order to survive. And eating disorder recovery is no different.
What makes you say relationships are the core of everything?
I think because if you have, I mean, from a simple perspective, like, okay, maybe I can grow things to try to feed myself and I can build my house. And, you know, maybe I'm somebody who can do all the things I need for my own shelter and my own food and my own safety. You know what? But I can love myself, but I need, as a fundamental human need, I need connection from other people. I need somebody to like love me and be in my world with me. That relationships really help us to get what we need because, of course, most of us can't build everything and grow everything and keep ourselves safe and do all those things because we were, you know, evolutionarily, we're meant to be together in community. No matter what you're, if you have a spiritual practice, community and connection is a really important theme. Like we actually do stuff in this life together more effectively than we tend to do it alone. And so I think the relationship piece is so important. And because eating disorders are so isolated, like we've been talking about, you know, that you're even in a relationship with the eating disorder. And so, you know, most people feel like the eating disorder is, however you conceptualize it, like the eating disorder messages are getting people to do things they wouldn't usually do. They're not really aligned with their values. They're not really aligned with how they want to see themselves in the world. So you have a relationship with an eating disorder. You're already in a relationship. So other relationships can help you to get out of that one.
That's a really good point. I completely agree with you there is that like they really are at the core of everything. And if you're feeling isolated, it's important to start reaching out so you can feel that connection. I find that connection can instantly change a person's mood,
right?
Like even on a spiritual level, as you referenced, like smiling at someone as they walk down the street can change their day and it can heal your day. Yep. It can make your day so much better. Just a smile.
Yep.
So when you are isolating and you're refusing to talk to people and you're building up all these stories, like people are hard. I don't like being around people. It's like, have you walked down the street and just tried to get eye contact with someone walking their dog?
Right.
You know, it actually isn't as hard and people are thirsty for connection. They really do want it as
well. They really do. And the people at the store, when you're going to wherever, go to Target or you're going to the grocery store, like the person that you might interface either at the checkout line or in the aisle, like those people are there, they're living their lives, particularly if they're working there and they're serving you, they would like to be acknowledged as a human too. And I think that's really at the core of it, that we want to be acknowledged as the people we are. We want to be seen. Everybody wants to be seen. And we have a really big need to feel like we belong. It's just wired into our DNA that we want to feel like we belong, that we have others beside us. And so it's okay to feel that. And you can practice little bits of it with those people you might never see again. Like, you know, the person who delivers your mail or the person at the checkout counter or the really nice person at Target that helped you when the self-checkout line broke down or whatever that machine does when I try to use it. Like that little bit of interaction can really, just like you're saying, help us to know we're not alone. and that we're okay, we're seen, and we actually can be connected, and it's okay. But sometimes it helps to just start small, those little connections.
Yeah, you actually remind me, the first person I told my eating disorder like story to, or when I was actually in recovery, was like a hostess at a restaurant I was working at, who was like 10 years older than me. And we had no connections in the world besides we were both hostesses at this restaurant. And I remember just openly saying, oh, I have an eating disorder, I'm in recovery. And I was really afraid to say that, because you just build up what someone's reaction is going to be, especially like I hadn't even said anything to like my family yet. So, you know, you imagine like your family melting down or something. But telling this person, I had no like big worries. So I just went on a limb and just vulnerably shared that with her. And she was like, wow, that really sucks. I'm so sorry. You know, I hope you get through that. Like, are you okay? Like, she just totally met me with that. And I learned in that moment, vulnerability helps build connection. And it also is often met even by strangers with a lot of compassion.
I think so. Absolutely. Because you would do that for somebody else. And I think that's what I continually remind people that I've worked with over the years. Like, you would do for somebody what the person will do for you. And you wouldn't even give it a second thought to say something like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I hope that, you know, can I help you? That's what that person's likely to say. How's that going to feel? Let's practice. Mm-hmm. And I think practicing, like this simple little thing that sounds wonky, and I do it all the time when I'm driving, but if you think about something in your head and you're like, oh, it's going to go like this, and I'm going to say this, and they're going to say that, don't do it in your head. Say it out loud. Like, talk to yourself as if you're the other person and you're you and you're having a conversation with them, because you find out it's way easier than you think it's going to be. And then when you get to the conversation with the person to like blurt out, oh, well, this is how I'm doing, could you help me? It's so much less bad than you think it's going to be. In part, in brain science tells us your brain actually thinks you already did it. So your brain like believes you did it. So the second time you do it, so much easier. So just saying it out loud, but you have to say it out loud. You can't just keep it in your head. So you want to, you know, be cautious about where you're talking aloud to yourself. Although, you know, with, you know, headphones and Bluetooth, you could talk to yourself wherever you want and people will think you're talking on the phone. Totally fine.
Wow. I love that. I actually love the idea of rehearsing lines out loud. I call them power statements, yes. Like the things you're really afraid to say, right? And then you come up with the simplest way to say it. So it's a statement. And then I will rehearse it in front of the mirror, which is saying it out loud. And then when you're actually in the moment where you're nervous and scared, you've already practiced. So it's so much more accessible.
Yep, it is.
In that moment.
Absolutely. It is. And you can rehearse it and you can say it and then you can be the other person and have them say one thing. And then you could say it again and then your other person could say a different thing. And you can go back and forth and exhaust as many, you know, versions of that conversation as you want till you find one you kind of like. It's awesome. Like, we have ourselves to practice with so that we can be with other people.
I love that. Well, this has been so wonderful, Jillian. I've loved chatting with you. Before I let you go, I just have one final question for you. What are some words of wisdom that you have for folks who are listening who are struggling with eating disorders?
Yeah, I love that question because I think it's so common that people will listen to a podcast or listen to something and say like, yeah, that's great, but that's not going to work for me. Or I don't think that that's going to happen for me, or it won't help for me. And I totally get it. I see you. I have been in that chair and thought like, yeah, that's great, but never going to work for me. I'm different, or I'm not worth it, or I can't do that, or whatever it is that you might be thinking, that it can. Like, don't give up. Really don't give up, because this illness won't give up. So you can't either. And if you don't give up, it will. And that's where I really think about it. Like, if it feels like a tug of war, like, yeah, you don't give up, it will. Eventually it will, because you can do this. So I really keep thinking like, yeah, you can do it. You can do it. Don't give up. This is not easy. You might fall down. You might have to get back up. That's okay. That's how this works. Don't give up, because you can do it. You can totally do it. And whether you like it or not, you do need other people to be able to help that process. And that's okay. And imagine yourself being that helper. How cool it would be someday for you to be that helper for somebody else. It's okay to help. It's okay to need to be helped.
I love that. Thank you for those words of wisdom. And for everyone listening who might want to learn more about your work or about your programs, how can they find you? Or I know you kind of represent all of Acanto Health. Like, what do you recommend they do if they're in need of more support?
Yeah, any of the websites, so the emilyprogram.com, veritascollaborative.com, any of our social channels, gatherbehavioralhealth.com. If you go to one, you'll get to any of the others. So Emily Program might be the easiest to remember. Go there. There's a lot of blogs. There's a lot of content. There's a lot of, I think, the message, and hopefully the messages I've been saying today, you'll feel in those digital, arenas. Because again, relationships, that's the thing. And so I just encourage somebody to check out the websites, look at us on social media, get a sense of all the people that are out there who really want to help. And I'm just thrilled to be able to do this work and to be able to work with a slew of people who have experienced these eating disorder illnesses themselves and really want to help people and really want to make a difference and know it's possible. So, take one brand, find us on social and you'll find the rest, and let us know if we can help. There's easy ways to reach out and connect with us. But connection, I think, particularly in digital ways, is a little easier sometimes than in real life. So connect. We'd love to hear from you.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Jillian. I hope you have a beautiful rest of your day.
You too. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome.
All right, that concludes this week's episode of the Full and Thriving Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this episode of the show. When you have a moment, please head on over to Instagram and follow my recovery coaching account at Meg_McCabe to stay up to date on everything I'm doing in recovery land. And if you're feeling extra inspired, please send me a direct message to let me know how this podcast has impacted your life. I'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.